Hi, welcome to Cochrane Alliance Church and our online sermons. We are so glad you are able to join us. We pray that this sermon will be a blessing and an encouragement to you this week.
Thank you for worshiping with us this morning. As we begin today, we begin a new series in the book of Esther. And so if you have a Bible with you, you can turn there. We're going to be going through chapter 1 this morning, and we'll find ourselves there. But as we begin, I want you to look at these images. Yeah, and now as you look, I'm sure a lot of things come to mind. Maybe what are they doing? Maybe something a lot more judgmental. But from the outside, it's obvious. What they're doing is not safe. This isn't stable. You may have done some of these things before and said, "What are you talking about? It's fine." I would venture to say it likely is not going to end well. And yet the person in the image, or if you found yourself in a situation like this, they still find themselves climbing, still reaching, still trusting that what they have put together will be strong enough to hold them. And in some ways, I think that's what makes this the most unsettling. The problem isn't just the structure, but it's the gap between what is actually true and what they believe is true. See, from the outside, the instability is likely clear. But from where they stand, it feels manageable. It feels controlled. It feels like it will hold at least long enough to get what they want. What they believe will hold doesn't just stay in their thinking, but it shapes how they act, how they respond, and how they will try to stay in control. And I think if we're honest, that's not just something that we see in images like this, but it's something that we experience in life. We trust what looks like it will hold until it doesn't. See, we live in this world that runs on visible power, positions, titles, influence, authority. And we assume that what looks strong actually is. We trust what appears stable, what seems in control, and what gives the impression that everything is being held together. And most of the time, we don't question it because it works until it doesn't. But every once in a while, there's this rub and something shifts. A decision is made that doesn't make sense. Leadership fails. Something we trusted doesn't hold the way that we thought it would. And in that moment, I believe something deeper begins to surface. And that's exactly where the book of Esther begins. As we step into chapter 1, we're introduced into a world where power looks impressive, structured, and in control, but underneath, something very different is happening. What begins to emerge is that there are two kinds of power at work in this world: what is visible and what is hidden. And as we'll see this morning, they are not the same. So if you have a Bible again, you can turn to Esther chapter 1, and I'm going to read through. You might want to follow along on the screen because I'm going to jump a little bit because it's a lengthy chapter. And so I've just kind of taken a few sections throughout that will help us this morning in our understanding. This is what we read. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the people, from the least to the greatest, who were in the citadel of Susa. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. And on the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times. According to the law, what must be done to Queen Vashti, he asked. Then Memucan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, "For the queen's conduct will become known to all women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, 'King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come.' There will be no end to disrespect and discord. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else. Then, when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands, from the least to the greatest." He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, proclaiming that every man should be ruler over his own household. Here we have in the book of Esther what begins with a spectacle. We're introduced to a king at the height of his power and an empire at its peak. For 180 days, 6 full months, the king gathers leaders from across this vast empire and puts his wealth, influence, and authority on display for all of them to see. Now, this is not simply a celebration or a moment of indulgence, but it is strategic, it is intentional, and it is deeply revealing. See, historically, this moment is tied to something very real. As Karen Jobes notes, this gathering likely corresponds to a war council where Xerxes was rallying support for a military campaign across his vast empire. Excess was being used as a tool of political control and consolidation. What we see in Xerxes is not unfamiliar. It's that same kind of visible power, but just on a very much larger scale. And the scale of this empire matters. You can see a little bit of it here on this map. Again, as the text said, it stretched across 127 provinces, from India to Kush. It was bringing together Egyptians, Babylonians, Persians, Medes, Greeks, and Indians, all under one rule, each with their own language, their customs, and way of life. This wasn't a single nation, but it was a collection of nations. And historians estimate that nearly half of the world's population lived under this empire. That's tens of millions of people spread across this enormous and diverse landscape. I share that with you because there's this truth. Holding something like that together required more than authority. It required belief. And for Xerxes, that belief had to be constantly reinforced. Power had to be seen to be believed. Because if people began to question his strength, then his control would begin to weaken. So Xerxes creates an environment where his greatness cannot be ignored. Day after day, over these 6 months, he showcases his wealth, his resources, and his authority so that those under his rule remain convinced that his power is absolute. Now, at the height of this display, he calls for his queen, Queen Vashti. But she is not summoned as a partner or a person. She is summoned as part of this presentation. She becomes another symbol of his greatness, another way for him to reinforce his image before those that were watching. And as Karen Jobes notes, she effectively becomes a living trophy of the king's glory. But in one moment, everything shifts as Vashti refuses to be brought out on parade. What had been carefully constructed over months now all of a sudden begins to unravel in an instant. Xerxes' visible display of power is beginning to show cracks. The king, who appears to control an empire, cannot control this one moment in his own household. What is revealed is not strength, but insecurity. Not stability, but fear. Not wisdom, but reaction. See, instead of responding with discernment, he responds with impulsivity. He listens to advisors who appeal to his pride and fear, and he makes this sweeping decree to protect his image. What begins as a personal moment quickly escalates into a decree that impacts the entire empire. See, at a certain point, something begins to shift. What once looked strong starts to raise different questions. No longer does this hold, but what is actually driving this? And this is good because underneath the surface, what appears stable is often being shaped by something much less secure. Fear, insecurity, and the need to protect. As Wallace Benn notes, the opening scene is designed to impress. But history tells us that this same king would later return defeated and diminished. Even within the chapter itself, the excess reveals something deeper. The repeated emphasis on luxury, on drinking and spectacle, quietly expose a lack of restraint and wisdom in the king and his court. When what we trust is threatened, we move quickly to defend it. Once we see that clearly, it becomes harder to keep this at a distance. Because at that point, we don't just see that in Xerxes, but I believe we recognize it in the world around us. We see it in leaders who cannot handle criticism, in workplaces where decisions are driven by image rather than integrity, and in relationships where control is disguised as strength. If we are honest, we see that this broken power isn't just out there, though. We see it in ourselves, in our everyday moments. Times such as when we get defensive the moment someone questions us. When we shut down instead of listening. When we make quick decisions just to regain a sense of control. When we say something we later regret because we felt exposed in the moment. Or more subtly, when we avoid conversations that we know we should have. When we protect our image instead of telling the truth. When we hold tightly to control because we're afraid of what happens if we don't. Those responses aren't random, but they reveal something about what we rely on. What we believe will actually hold things together. Many of us trust systems, stability, or control more than we trust God. And often we don't even realize it. Because of that, we rely on what appears strong, this visible power. And when that becomes clear, it doesn't just change how you then think about power, but it changes how you experience the world around you. Because if what looks strong isn't holding things together, then the question becomes unavoidable. What does that kind of trust produce? Well, what we see in Xerxes is this. When trust is placed in what only looks strong, the result is never stability. It's damage. The same power we saw in Xerxes doesn't just exist, but it creates something. It shapes decisions, it influences environments, and it begins to affect people far beyond that original moment. And this is where the story shifts from what power is to what power does. Misplaced trust is not just fragile, but it is dangerous. The king operates impulsively. He listens to voices around him that reinforce his pride and his fear. He makes sweeping decisions in emotional moments without considering their broader impact. As one commentator describes it, this kind of power becomes unpredictable and unsafe. When authority is driven by insecurity rather than wisdom, the consequences spread far beyond the original moment. Broken power does not stay contained. It spreads. For Xerxes, what begins as a personal conflict becomes a decree that shapes the lives of an entire empire. This wasn't just about Vashti, but this became law. What started as a moment quickly turned into a policy that affected people across these provinces, cultures, and communities. And in this, we see that this kind of power doesn't stay personal, but it becomes structural. It begins to shape systems, expectations, and norms. It starts to define what is acceptable, what is expected, and what is enforced. And that means the impact reaches far beyond the people in the room where the decision was made. There's a widely discussed and at times debated example of this from the 1970s. That I think helps bring this into focus. In the 1970s, Ford Motor Company was developing a new vehicle, the Ford Pinto. Now, during testing, engineers discovered a serious design flaw. It was in the rear-end collision. In rear-end collisions, the gas tank could rupture and cause the car to catch fire. The issue was known, and the fix was relatively simple and inexpensive. But instead of correcting it, a different decision was made. A cost analysis was done comparing the price of fixing the issue against the projected cost of lawsuits and settlements. And the conclusion was that it would be more efficient not to fix the problem. So the car went to market as it was. See, the people who paid the price then were not the ones making the decision. They were not the executives, not the people in the room when the analysis was done, but it was ordinary people. Drivers, families, individuals who had no idea that a decision had been made that would directly affect their safety. Now let's go back to Esther. The same was true for the people of that kingdom. Most people in the story didn't make that decision, but they were going to live under it. Across the empire, households would now be shaped by this sweeping decree by King Xerxes. Wives, families, and communities would feel the effects of a decision rooted not in wisdom, but in fear. What was normalized in leadership would begin to be reflected in everyday life. Control would be reinforced, fear would be legitimized, and insecurity would quietly become part of the culture. That is the damage of broken power. it multiplies itself. It moves from the top down, shaping environments, influencing relationships, and affecting people who had no say in how it began. The same dynamics that shaped this moment in Esther are not limited, though, to kings and empires. They show up much closer to home. The same patterns that we see in Xerxes, I believe, show up in us. It shows up in our need for control. In the moments where we feel uncertain, in the moments we try to manage outcomes, direct conversations, or force clarity where it doesn't exist. And when things don't go the way we expect, we don't always respond with wisdom, but we react. We tighten our grip. We try to regain control, not because it's right, but because it's safer. I think sometimes that looks like replaying a conversation in your head before it even happens, deciding what needs to be said, how it needs to go, and how the other person should respond. And when it doesn't unfold that way, frustration rises quickly, not because the outcome matters most, but because control was lost. It shows up in how we manage our image. We become aware of how we are perceived and how we begin to protect that perception. We avoid situations that might expose weakness. We shape conversations to maintain appearance. And sometimes we choose what protects how we look over what is actually true. I think this can look like knowing you should admit something, but choosing not to because of how it might change how people see you. So you adjust the story slightly. You leave details out, not to deceive outright, but to preserve the image that you've worked so hard to maintain. It shows up in fear. Not always in obvious ways, but in subtle decisions. We make choices to avoid loss, to prevent discomfort, to keep things stable. And in those moments, we are not always being led by wisdom, but we are being led by fear. It might look like staying quiet when something needs to be said, or holding back from stepping into something you know you should pursue. Not because it's wrong, but because it feels uncertain. And in that moment, the decision isn't being shaped by clarity, it's being shaped by fear. And when those patterns begin to take root, they don't stay contained. They affect how we lead, how we respond, how we relate to others. They shape the environments that we're a part of, our homes, our workplaces, our relationships. What starts internally begins to express itself externally. And so that brings us back to what's underneath all of this. Because the issue is not just behavior, but it's trust. When control becomes our instinct and self-protection becomes our reflex, it reveals something deeper about what we are relying on. It exposes what we believe will actually hold things together. Whatever you trust, you will protect. If you trust control, you will protect it. If you trust your image, you will defend it. If you trust stability, you will fight to preserve it. And when those things feel threatened, you will respond quickly and often without thinking. That is exactly what we saw in Xerxes, and it's exactly what we often see in ourselves. Which means the issue is not just power, but it is misplaced trust. When trust is misplaced, the effects are never isolated. They move outward. They impact others. They shape environments. They create consequences. They extend far beyond the original moment. And that is the warning of Esther. And that warning that chapter 1 leaves with us. Not just that power can fail, but that trusting the wrong kind of power always comes at a cost. And if this kind of power, or this kind of world we live in, where power is unstable, where decisions don't always make sense, where people are affected by things they didn't choose, then the question begins to surface. Not always out loud, but I believe quietly underneath it all. Where is God in this? It's an interesting question to explore in the context of the book of Esther. Because as we will see, nowhere in the book itself is God actually mentioned. There's no clear indication of his activity, no moment where he steps in to correct what is happening, no visible sign that he is directing events. And that absence immediately creates tension. Because if God is not named and his activity is not obvious, then we are left asking, what is he actually doing? If anything at all. And yet I don't believe that this absence is accidental. Although the writer never names God, we will see that he assumes his presence in every moment of the story. And that means what we are reading is not a godless story, but it is a story where God is working quietly beneath the surface. And that begins to reshape how we read what's happening. Because instead of looking for obvious intervention, we are invited to pay attention differently. To look beneath what is visible, and to consider that God's activity may not always present itself in the ways that we expect. I believe Esther is teaching us something essential. God may feel distant, but he is not disengaged. God's power in this story, although not visible, it is hidden. How many times have you felt that in life? That God is distant, maybe even disengaged. For many of us, we've had moments where God doesn't seem obvious. Moments where you've prayed and nothing has changed. Where you've asked for direction and the answer didn't come. Where you've tried to do what's right and the outcome just didn't make sense. And in those moments, the question isn't always spoken out loud, but I believe it's there. Where is God in this? Some of us have asked that question recently. Not as theory, but because something didn't turn out how we expected. Something didn't resolve as we had hoped. Something we trusted God with didn't unfold the way that we thought it would. And what makes that even more difficult is not just the situation itself. It's the lack of clarity around it. No clear answer. No obvious direction. No visible movement. In these moments, I believe the question must shift. From where is God in this, to will we trust him even when we cannot see it? And it's right there
in that space that Esther meets us.
Because this story doesn't begin by resolving that tension.
It begins by actually deepening it.
As Karen Jobes points out in her commentary, this will be an anchor throughout our series. The narrative of Esther does not simplify human behavior or present clear-cut moral categories. Instead, it portrays a world where decisions are often mixed, imperfect, and at times questionable. Yet God's purposes continue to move forward within that complexity.
That forces us to wrestle with something deeper. Because if God is at work here, he is not working through ideal circumstances or perfectly clear decisions. He's working through complexity. In other words, God's sovereignty is not limited to ideal conditions, but it is at work even when human motives are unclear, when decisions are messy, and when outcomes are not what we would expect. God's purposes are not limited by imperfect circumstances. That doesn't mean it always makes sense. It doesn't mean we always understand it. But it does mean we trust God even in the uncertainty. I'll invite the worship team to come as we close. See, even in this chaotic situation in chapter 1, the king's insecurity, the advisor's manipulation, the escalation of personal conflict is unfolding within God's providence. And yet, that doesn't immediately remove the tension. It doesn't suddenly make everything clear. It doesn't answer every question we carry, but instead it leaves us with something different. Not full clarity, but a deeper invitation to trust that God is at work, even when we cannot see how. And to wrestle honestly with what that means in the kind of world that Esther has just shown us. See, Esther 1 introduces us to two kinds of power. Visible power, kings, empires, authority, and control, but also hidden power, God's providence, unseen work, and quiet direction. And throughout this chapter, one looks strong while the other remains unseen, but they are not equal. Because what looks strong is already beginning to crack, and what cannot be seen is still at work. Every one of us is building our lives on something we believe will hold. The question is not which one exists, but the question is which one are you trusting? And that's not just a question for a moment like this, it's a question to carry with you. Because you will walk into situations where something looks stable, but underneath it is not. And in these moments, the question is no longer what looks strong, but what and who you trust will actually hold. And our prayer is that you would learn and turn to the hidden power of God.